Hello, and welcome to Darker Corners, the best and only Justice League Dark Show. This is episode 9. I'm the host, Nick Antoine. Argus is pretty badass. Recognize. Old business. All graphic novels are worthy, and they should be read. What matters is the state of mind of the reader. New business. Although cobbled, the last message was brought to you by the letter E for equality, emblems, and edamame. Justice League Dark number 9, The Black Room. There was a slight creative shift. I don't recollect what that was because I try not to pay attention to that stuff, even though the whole point of this podcast is to give you guys information. You gals and guys, I don't think it's necessary, personally. When you go to a museum, if you go to museums and you look at works of art, whether they be sculptures or paintings, do you sit there and wonder exactly how much, I don't want to say how much turmoil, but what it was that was going through the minds of the patrons of that art, the people who paid the money for that art to be made. If there were previous artists that were involved or other artists at the same time that were maybe uncredited, that were, for instance, helping to mold the toes of the statue of David. No, at best you're wondering what's going on in the mind of the artist. Not if the artist had a beef with another artist or if an artist was friends with another artist and created a particular work of art that was controversial, whatever the case may be. I don't know. So we've had 8 issues of one particular creative team creating this redundancy, this intriguing, eclectic group of individuals to take down magical threats to the DC multiverse. It's now being written by Jeff Lemire, with art being the pencils and the inks. And again, you know, just for anyone that doesn't know, if you listen to this, you probably do, but if you don't know, it's there's a huge storyboard or just a huge sheet of paper, just make it even more attainable. The artist will then, you know, draw the rectangles and squares, or they'll draw the art and then the squares and stuff around it, but they'll draw the art. And then sometimes an inker will come along with ink, with different size brushes, different size pens, and, you know, in essence, darken it so it comes more to life. And the strokes that are there for in the pencil drawings that help to create shape for all the different objects, if they're necessary, they're kept. If they're unnecessary, they're not erased, but just not inked. And then the colorist comes in and colors in between the lines. Which sounds reductionist, but it's not. It's difficult because there's so many layers to it, and that's why there's so many color production houses. The colors in this case were done by Ulysses Ariola, and this individual, as well as the rest, are the same creative team from the previous 8 issues, helping to keep the tone that's trying to be conveyed consistent, with the lettering done by Rob Lee. The cover done by Ryan Suk, continuing his immaculate run on covers in this series. The associate editor was Chris Conroy, and I'm leaving it at that. That's an inside joke for people that have been listening. And the main editor was Matt Idelson. I'll leave that at that as well. We find a typical hostage situation. I say typical, not in a negative light, but, you know, it's a hostage situation. An individual is hooded, and in this case brought to the center of the Amazon jungle. And some words are exchanged, and we find out who the individual is that's been hooded. What is, I don't want to say slightly more important, but is definitely worth pointing out, is the appearance of Felix Faust. Let's say Faust. I'll probably end up saying that more often than not. Felix Faust is a bad guy, obviously, but just look at that definition. Bad guy is just an individual who's going against the status quo. The status quo in this case would have been people who bleed the universe of its magical essence to use for their own purposes, so long as they don't hurt a lot of people. And that's psychically or physically hurt other people, even emotionally. Whereas, quote-unquote, the bad guy won't necessarily be looking out for the welfare of others. That's morally bad, but let's not even go into that whole back and forth. What is interesting about this individual, despite the fact that he originated in 1962 as an adversary of the JLA, or Justice League of America, and is also partly, I don't want to say wholly, but at least partly based on Dr. Faustus. Just look up Dr. Faustus, or Dr. Faust. A lot of similarities there. What's intriguing is, as per the Wikipedia, he was not that much of a fighter, hand-to-hand. Didn't do a lot of that stuff, but he was, according to Wikipedia, a master sorcerer, able to control vast magical power to affect reality itself. Which goes on the theme of a previous episode, reality being altered. When he first appeared, Faust was unique amongst other magicians of his caliber, and this is the most intriguing aspect, because apparently he required books or scrolls of spells to focus his powers. What's interesting about that is, usually when you see magic being portrayed in art, whether it's in a painting, or it's in literature, or it's on film or in television, the sorcerer or sorceress is always incanting enchantments from a spell book. I can definitely say from my own experiences in life that individuals that are dedicated to whatever craft they're working are usually more focused than that. Using different journals, grimoires, spell books, whatever the case may be, they're all there to edify the mind. They help to release that dopamine rush of feeling as if you're doing the right thing that you get from, you know, that adrenaline rush that you get from a roller coaster ride, or when you're in a car with somebody that's decided to put the pedal to the metal, and now you're going 100 miles an hour and it's 1 o'clock in the morning down a dusty road, or you've achieved some goal you set out for yourself, whether in the business side of your life or the personal side of your life, that sensation that you feel is what is trying to be achieved by people who are practitioners of the occult. I'm talking about in the real world. And you can liken that to people who practice any other religion. The occult is a religion in itself. I believe it just being able to pull strand-wise from Judeo-Christian, from ancient Babylonian, or let's just say the Mesopotamian the Islamic faiths, Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, Shintoism, looking at different the basis of different religions, and seeing what the commonalities are, and trying to use those commonalities to make the practitioner, the person that's practicing this version of the occult, whatever that version is, to make themselves feel better when it comes to facing tomorrow. Or at the very least, facing today. That, in essence, is a boiled down understanding of why people practice the occult. So it's very interesting that when it's portrayed, anytime that you end up seeing somebody practicing the occult, they in essence are made to look like they are an acolyte, somebody that's new in the game, if you will, and they need to consistently read some spell book to see where they're coming from, for the audience to be able to see where they're coming from as a spellcaster. As an example, it's a vast dichotomy, but look at, let's say, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Yes, it's a Disney film, but all art is art. And then look at Hellraiser 4, or Hellraiser Bloodlines, if I'm not mistaken, that was the name of it. And The Sorcerer's Apprentice, there are spell books that are needed, and it's actually the focal point of some of the story, if not most, depending on who you are when you're watching it. If you look at Hellraiser Bloodlines, when Le Marchand, the individual who builds the lament configuration, the box that's known about in Hellraiser, in Hellraiser series and in fandom. He brings it to an aristocrat, and his helper, his I don't want to say his servant, but his assistant, which keen eyes will spot, is portrayed by the actor Adam Scott of Parks and Recreation fame. He plays Ben Wyatt. I know way too much about media. I need to pull back. the incantor in this situation does not look at a spell book. He just incants in Latin what needs to be said, and the spell that's being cast is cast, and the desired outcome occurs. It shows the vast difference between the authors of the source material and what they believe to be necessary for a practitioner of the occult to achieve what they're trying to achieve. All of that being said, again, this is falling into that trope of an individual, Felix Faust in this case, an individual who's supposed to be highly proficient in the occult, yet being portrayed as someone that needs to read something that they should have, if you think about it, have read already. It's as if you were to see an electrician working on a utility pole, and they have a 900-page book detailing exactly which circuit goes where. You would think by the time they got to the point that they'd have to fix the circuit, they'd know what they were doing. And if they were using anything for reference, they'd be referencing in the car. So a sorcerer or a sorceress, let's switch that around, a sorceress or a sorcerer that is practicing what they quote-unquote preach, they, at the most, or I guess in this case, at the worst, would be going over a spell book on the train or in the car on the way to wherever it is they're going to if they need to refresh themselves. Again, quoting Wikipedia, in recent appearances, quote-unquote, he seems to have overcome this disadvantage. It's not gone into here, but I figured it was better to expand upon why it would be seen as a disadvantage. When Felix Faust first appeared in Justice League of America 9, again, this is way back in the 60s, he was using the Necronomicon, the occult book from the stories of H.P. Lovecraft, to summon three demons. In a later appearance, the title of the work was changed from the Necronomicon to something else. I'd like to point out as well that a lot of people like to cite the Necronomicon as a source of dark magic that is real, something that can be used. And I think that's an intriguing thing to look upon. The Necronomicon was, in essence, something that was hinted at in different books and then explicitly stated by H.P. Lovecraft in his works. But it didn't necessarily exist before then, depending on what sources you read. Some sources will say, oh no, it's existed since the Mad Magician. That's a real deep cut. That's a deep reference, if you know what I'm talking about. And most others will say, oh no, this was a fabrication after the fact. But I don't think either one becomes mutually exclusive from the other. I don't think either one makes one less pertinent than the other. If one is to go on the belief that people that practice the occult are really just trying to find a way to cope with what's ailing them. So you'll have people that might, quote unquote, go towards the lighter side of the force. I know I'm really going there here, but to use earth magic or to heal themselves or to heal others, or somebody will be going to, quote unquote, the darker side of the force because they want to cause harm to others, or they want to feed the greedy essence within themselves that needs to satiate their need for money or fame or food or luxury. Either one of those individuals are really just trying to cope with the fact that there are so many other people on this planet, in this plane of existence, that have their own freedom of choice. And that feeling of alienation, that feeling of not being able to make the same choices as other people, drives some to the belief that, in essence, praying to this particular invisible being is more potent than praying to that invisible being. And in this case, I'm saying, in essence, praying to Baphomet or praying to Isis, as opposed to praying to Allah or God or Jehovah or Buddha. they are all placeholders for the unknown that knows all, that's separate from the individual who's knowledgeless. They don't know exactly what it is that they need. They just know what they want. So they call out to something that they've envisioned in their mind, something they've created within themselves to make sense of the world. I'm going to get to back to that a little bit later in this idea of existential psychotherapy. But we'll get back to that in a second. What does matter at the moment is the fact that Felix Faust, this individual who's quite prevalent in the forthcoming aspects, I guess you could say, aspects, issues of Justice League Dark, is an individual who is seeking control in the same way that you would see somebody like a Lex Luthor, or in the fictional world, or in the real world, a world leader, somebody who's the head of a country, perhaps a young country, and they are seeking power because they feel that power is the be-all end-all and not respect. I'm not singling out any one country or another. I'm just saying that it's one of those telltale signs of a country that is not exactly sure what their place in the grander scheme of things should be, if they lash out at their neighbors without the foresight to know that their neighbor's children just might not forget. But because we don't necessarily want to ruffle any feathers regardless of country affiliation or citizenship, we move forward, because this is a podcast about graphic novels, and more specifically the occult and nature. And so we have the reveal of the new team on a splash page. Now, some of them are holdovers from the previous 8 issues, them being Zatanna, practicing her backwards magic, John Constantine, doing what he does best in the foray, as everyone is trading blows, he's lighting a cigarette, and Deadman, the acrobat who plummeted to his death after being fatally wounded, which is a messed up sentence. He was shot and then fell to his death from the high wire. If he was fatally wounded, he would have been dead before he hit the floor. But there are 2 new additions to the team as of yet, one being Andrew Bennett and the other being the Black Orchid. Now, I could go heavily in depth as to the background of Andrew Bennett, who he is, where he comes from. There's a reference on page 6, digital page 6, that's when I start saying digital XX, digital page 6, that says, if I'm not mistaken, waiting for it to load, to check out issue 9, if I'm not mistaken, of, it comes up a little later, it says here to just check out the Rise of the Vampires. In this case, it would be check out the even-numbered Rise of the Vampires, which I mentioned in the previous episode, which all take place in I, Vampire, that graphic novel. If you're behind on that, I highly recommend picking that up. If you've been reading this far, you probably picked up at the very least the side issues that connect with this, issues 7 and 8, and technically it goes on until, I believe, issue 14. But just go and check it out. It's 19 issues. It's really not that bad. Either you're going to be paying full price digitally, so 99 cents each, so $19. Or I guess in this case, 1881, or there's some special, there's probably a graphic novel collection compendium that's all of that I, Vampire run from the New 52. Go buy that, dccomics.com, seriously, it's worth it. If for whatever reason you don't want to buy the entire run and you just want to get the first issue, or you just want to hear the backstories and kind of the world that's being crafted, go and listen to Be in the Queue, Bennett and the Queen. It's over on iTunes as well. Twitter it up, B and the Q, capital B, capital Q. There you can get much more information on Andrew Bennett, his motivations, his partner in crime, if you will, and his very own antagonist that decides that he wants to do things the way that he does. But who I will focus on is Black Orchid, or at least slightly focus on. She's a completely new individual coming up to this point in the series. She had not been seen. This, as you would say, I guess, properly, this is her first appearance in the New 52. Unless I'm mistaken, you can go ahead and email me, which probably means I'm very, very wrong. But as far as I can tell, she didn't pop up anywhere else, you know. Yeah, because the Argus series for the New 52 for the Trinity War happened after issue 9 for Justice League Dark. It happened when the Trinity War started up. What was the other stuff? Yeah, it was Trinity War. It wasn't anything before that. The same thing with anything regarding the Black Room, which is I might slightly speak on a little bit later. She had a lot of different incarnations, 4 to be exact, despite the fact that she started up in July/August of 1973 in Adventure Comics number 428. What's intriguing about her is that, as I said, there were 4 different incarnations. The Black/Susie version, or Black/Susie version, was created by Neil Gaiman and Dave McKean, but the current version was created by this new team, Jeff Lemire and Michael Janin. What's intriguing is that I think it's a very understated fact that she's Hispanic. I think it might be slight sexism, and people don't necessarily notice. They'll see a female hero, and then they'll look for all the quote-unquote negative qualities that are portrayed. I don't think it's negative, but people go out of their way to look at them as negative. So the things that identify gender, not personality. So yes, a penis identifies a male. Breasts and a V-line, in essence, a flat V-line, if you will. I say that because it's not super skin tight in that area, in the pubis. That identify a female. Those are the things that separate them as genders, but their personalities are what makes them individual human beings. The things that separate them, gender-wise, are usually what's used to accentuate why that individual should not be portrayed the way that they're portrayed. And more often than not, it's the female character that is made the scapegoat for personal dissatisfaction. When, if you look at it, there aren't that many male characters with the exception of John Constantine. I guess even looking at it now, like the different people that are in his world, the different male characters, like the Felix Faust, who's going to come up much later. Oh, what's his name? What is his name? I was going to say Tom Kalmaku, but that's Green Lantern's, or Hal Jordan's friend at Ferris Air. There's an individual. He's got the Books of Magic, and I just spoiled something, and I really shouldn't have, for much, 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 much later in the series. But his name is Tom. Oh, it's Tom something. I should know this, but I never read the Books of Magic. My bad, everyone that's listening. But usually, those male characters are wearing normal clothes. Though they're, in essence, their superhero disguise is to look like their normal selves. They're Clark Kent versions of themselves. So, you know, slacks, a shirt or a t-shirt, you know, button-down shirt or a t-shirt, a tie or no tie, a jacket. You know, it's just normal clothes, which I think is very comforting to see somebody that's being normal be super normal, if you will. But for the most part, male characters are just as identified by their gender as female characters are. I see just as many male breasts as I see female breasts, if not more, because of what's the actual case, the subconscious, or I guess you would say unintended sexism of having a higher male to female ratio of heroes in graphic novels. But I think that's just the reluctance of male readers to read a female comic book and not sexualize the character. That's not a negative trait. Again, I spoke about this in the previous episode. Our sexuality is what defines us as human beings. The things that we find attractive are the things that we gravitate towards. It doesn't mean that we once finding that thing attractive or sexually stimulating, that we automatically have a rush of blood to the genitalia, whether that's male or female. It's not necessarily the case. That's a very male view of what sexual attraction is. A lot of that attraction is within the mind. There are traits that cause you to want to get to know that individual more. What's intriguing is that a lot of male readers, and I'm not generalizing the millions of male readers that already exist, I'd say even billions by this point in time, but just the male readers that I've come to know that read graphic novels, they don't read female centered graphic novels, yet they will look at those female characters as sexy in one way, shape, or form. But then if they read those types of graphic novels that entail superheroes, they'll read male ones that have accentuated sexual features. So the Hulk, somebody who's literally Mr. Universe running around in underpants. The explanation given that, oh, he bursts out of his clothes, that's imagery in itself, bursting forth through the threshold to unleash their manhood on the world. I'm not trying to have some weird reversed feminist ideology here going on. I guess strictly feminist, not reverse feminist, because that would be what's the word I'm looking for? I was just going to say just male sexism, chauvinism. There you go, male chauvinism. But it's intriguing that, you know, I've said before, when it comes to costume superheroes in the DC universe, I prefer Superman and Icon. But clearly, those are the ideals that I have in my head of what I think a heterosexual male should be at the apex. When looking at the female characters, I mentioned this in the previous episode, I thoroughly enjoy reading Wonder Woman. I've mentioned it already, going by that, Brian Cunningham and Cliff Chiang, Chiang, they're doing the current run. It's up to 30. Just gave away exactly when I've been recording these. or at least the month. Let's not go out of our way to trivialize the beauty of the human form, albeit male or female. More often than not, as a reader, you're reading these things in the comfort of your own home. Embrace the fact that you're reading this male Greek god perform all these wondrous stunts in modern day times. And that you're reading it and enjoying it because you see yourself in that, and you may not be able to see yourself in a female character. Embrace that, but then know that there's nothing wrong to pick up a copy or a run of Batwoman or Batgirl or Catwoman or Wonder Woman or any other run that occurs. If I'm not mistaken, the Suicide Squad was Harley Quinn centered, and that was before Harley Quinn even got her own graphic novel series. I'm talking about all New 52, of course, this stuff before, but I'm talking about New 52 universe. Don't be afraid to see yourself in that mindset to make the story that much more relatable to yourself. That's the whole point of art. You're supposed to challenge yourself. It doesn't mean that if you read a graphic novel that centers around a woman, you're now going to want to have copious amounts of sex with a man. If you're a man, and even if that's the case, that's not a problem. You just discovered something within yourself through a graphic novel. If that's not the entire point of creating art in the first place, why are all of the artists continuing to create art? I apologize to anyone that was disgruntled by my opinions. You know, they're clearly mine. I don't work for DC Comics or Warner Brothers in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, it's definitely worth pointing out that it's very odd that people want to escape through art and not be changed by art. That's unfair to the artist. I'm biased with that opinion. My original point being, this version of Black Orchid is named Alba Garcia. She's Hispanic. And I feel like that should be accentuated more. That should be pointed out, not because it's different in a bad way, but different in a good way. Because her race does not define her powers or her need to be involved with this group of people. It's what she brings to the table, which only accentuates my point of not using race or gender as the definer of the individual. What defines her is, for instance, in this particular issue, her shape-shifting abilities, they definitely come into play and help them gain the element of surprise in one way, shape, or form, which again is something that this team definitely needed because they stand out like a sore thumb, given what they're capable of doing, and especially later on once the team malleates in, you know, the way that any Justice League team will, again, they'll continue to stand out. I'd like to point out John Constantine's room. It's pretty funny. What's funny about it, in my opinion, are two things, really. There's a lot of funny things. But the first one being, this is issue 9, which means it would be 2 years, so it came out in 2012. Chances are in March or April of 2012. He's got a desktop computer on his desk that shows the state of squalor he lives in, because nobody has desktop computers anymore, and if they do, they don't have a tower like that. His tower is so bulky, it looks as if it's got a CD player and a floppy disk. I mean, it's funny, and I don't know if that was intentional to make it look as if he's buying things from a thrift store, or it's a callback to Hellblazer during the run when he ended up doing business, I'll just say without spoiling anything, with an old friend, and it involved a computer and cyberspace, intriguingly enough, again in the 80s, just forward thinking. And the second thing is the rolls of toilet paper, and that's just the signature of Bachelorhood. I always feel like people never expand upon that. It's because toilet paper goes quickly, and especially if you're not eating well, toilet paper goes quickly. And most people that are living alone, for the most part, are just eating to survive. Not because they can't afford it, but just because it's they eat out of necessity. You'll have the rarities, like in bigger cities, you'll have somebody that's a bachelorette or a bachelor, and, you know, single, that's eating at finer establishments, whether it's a Spago or a Chipotle, they're eating better quality foods than an individual who's just going to, you know, a local supermarket and picking up a bunch of food in bulk so you could throw it in a cabinet and then cook it up when necessary. So it's a mainstay. And I guess I'll point out as well, he's still very much an avid drinker. We get the introduction in this graphic novel series of Steve Trevor. He's popped up in different places. He was in Justice League. I know he wasn't in, I don't want to say I know. I believe he had a cameo in issue 2 of Justice League. It might have been issue 3. But he became more prevalent later on as his connection to Argus, as well as with Amanda Waller, and the various rooms, the Black Room, the Red Room, and .. I don't want to spoil anything. They are different rooms that house different things. The Black Room, again, I don't want to spoil too much, but the Black Room, in essence, are occult artifacts from the DC multiverse that have been collected. Its location, I'm keeping quiet about. The Red Room, those are technological artifacts from the DC multiverse. So, you know, a lot of times, more often than not, it's alien technology. There's nothing occult about it. It's all alien technology. And they keep that in the Red Room. And then there's the other room. His connection to Argus and Amanda Waller is fascinating because it shows this dynamic. You see this in other graphic novels more, especially in the New 52, like in the Argus series, like in Justice League, I want to say Justice League of America. Yes, because Justice League United just recently started. That's the Canadian branch. Justice League of America. And I believe he even had some dabbling in Justice League International, which I think people should reread because Booster Gold is in it, and he's always been one of those pivotal characters, at least in the last 10 to 20 years. It's very fascinating how that series ended. It ended in the JLI, Justice League International annual. Weird. I feel like it still hasn't been talked about, not properly. So I know that's coming back to bite everybody, all the readers in the ass. But he was more prevalent in Justice League of America because he had a direct hand via Amanda Waller of putting all those guys together. being spearheaded by Martian Manhunter, another underused character in the New 52, but I believe for a reason. May have been overexposed before, but not to great effect pre-Flashpoint. That's not a slight. I don't know who specifically was writing him everywhere. I know there was a run with, I want to say, John Ostrander. That was actually really, really good. Bizarre. Check that out. That's pre-Flashpoint. It's one of the few things, with the exception of Hellblazer, I'm going to recommend to people if you're reading New 52. It's bizarre. Martian Manhunter. I think it's only like 16 issues. It's quick run. It might be like 30. Who knows? But if you want to see Amanda Waller in action, you, of course, can check out there's a couple of episodes here and there of Justice League, and then more specifically Justice League Unlimited, the cartoon. Chances are, if you're reading these graphic novels or listening to this podcast, you've seen those already. She pops up in Batman Beyond in one way, shape, or form, with no spoilers. And she also was portrayed in the Green Lantern film by... Oh, I was about to sound really racist, even though I'm black. I was going to say Vivica Fox, but I know it's not Vivica Fox. Angela Bassett. Because every time I think Angela Bassett, I think What's Love Got to Do with It. That was the first time I ever saw her in a movie. She was just amazing in that film. As was Lawrence Fishburne. I actually couldn't watch him in anything else until The Matrix, because it was such a tonal shift as in character between those two. But I just saw him as Ike Turner for years. It was really creepy. It was really creepy. They both did amazing jobs in that movie. But yeah, she played Amanda Waller and was an attempt to get things started. But now there's another version. I take that back. There was one in Smallville as well. And that was played by Pam Grier. Another great interpretation. Smallville, another underrated show. For 10 years, they were able to string out the story of Superboy. It was just amazing. All these different characters showing up. It was a great show. It was a great, if you will, Elseworlds situation going on. It was very, very cool. Alternate universe. Let's just say the... You know, Earth. Let's say Earth 10. Let's just say that. I know that's not right, but it had 10 years, so let's say Earth 10. The current version of Amanda Waller is played by Cynthia Robinson. I want to say Cynthia Robinson Adai. It could be Cynthia Adai Robinson. So sorry to the actress or actor, whatever she prefers. She's playing Amanda Waller on Arrow, and an intriguing version of it because it's, you know, she's very comfortable wielding power, but she's not power hungry, which I think is an accurate portrayal from both the Justice League cartoons and, you know, Justice League Unlimited, and her appearances in graphic novels pre-Flashpoint. She's not an individual like a young Lex Luthor, who would have been intelligent and had resources and tried to dominate using her power. It was more like a puppet master wielding people when necessary, a la ALA. I just like saying that, but IE, people just assume I mean ALLAH, IE, the Suicide Squad. Wow, that was a horrible, horrible juxtaposition there. But you know what I'm saying. Amanda Waller, she controls the Suicide Squad. People like Deadshot and Harley Quinn, and I know Frankenstein's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I feel like he might have been on the Suicide Squad once or twice. The Red Hood, and I know I'm talking more New 52 stuff, but it's fascinating how she ends up being portrayed in the New 52, and to have that dynamic between her and Steve Trevor be played out in various different graphic novels, I think is a nice, unique take on a government liaison agency interacting with superheroes from a publishing house. I believe putting Argus in different shows, I feel like it's inevitable that The Flash show that's coming to the CW in the fall eventually will have some interaction with Argus, because they're bound to have interactions with Star Labs, because that's kind of his go-to, where even though Barry Allen works at the police station as a forensic scientist, the Flash persona ends up interacting with Star Labs the same way that Bruce Wayne ends up interacting with the public on a day-to-day basis, but as a philanthropist, but his Batman persona interacts with the police department, but at a high level. Instead of going to the regular, you know, detectives or boys in blue, he deals with the commissioner of the police department for the city, which is a very, very analogous. I think it's bound to happen that there's going to be an overlap where a government agency is going to say, okay, you got all these bizarre metahumans. And that's, if you didn't know already, the DC term for superhumans, metahumans, it's a DNA thing, people. all these metahumans that are cropping up in your city. It'd be very much in our, I'm speaking in quotes here, very much in our interest to keep tabs on that. So to have her pop up and kind of be the impetus behind taking down an individual that's maybe a little bit more human than meta. Again, more fascinating things. There's an object that's not even alluded to, it's just outright shown, which is, yes, Dr. Destiny's Dreamstone. I'm pointing it out because it causes John Constantine to have a tonal shift and go from, you know, get out of my apartment, Steve Trevor, to, okay, yes, I'm totally willing to help. if you're going to give me anything that's close to what that is, I'm totally down. What's worth pointing out is, okay, this Dreamstone. Yes, it's pink, and it may seem like there's, you know, nothing special about that. I say that just because the normal stereotype is, I want something that's some bright color that's not normally worn by people. It's not worthy of paying attention to. So, yeah, it's a magical artifact. So if something is, you know, bright pink or bright yellow or, like, really bright green, like, beyond being jade as a color, it's not normally paid attention to. And when it is, it's then made really, really awesome in the context of the story. So I would like to use as an example Big Trouble in Little China. Even though there is so many cool things going on in the film, I believe the thing that attracted a lot of people, I know myself, but a lot of different people to the storyline was the motivation behind the main bad guy in the film, which was to marry a girl with green eyes. It was just the weirdest, it was just a weird sentence. Like, really? Like, this is the 20th century. Like, go on a date. You just meet somebody, doesn't matter who they are, but to be so adamant, like, no, it has to be a girl with green eyes, woman with green eyes. It was just so weird. It was such a weird quirk to have that it genuinely, you know, does what it was supposed to. It causes a glint in the corner of your eye, in your peripheral vision, that causes you to seemingly lose focus from the main objective, or I guess in all actuality, lose focus. But that allows the author of that work to then create something even bigger to catch you off guard when you put your focus back on what the main objective is, which is, I guess, in that movie, to take down Lo Pan. I just remembered his name. I can't believe that. I haven't seen that movie in so long. John Constantine decides to go with them, and they end up finding themselves at the building that Felix Faust is holed up in. He himself having captured, who is it in this? Dr. Mist. Yes, Dr. Mist. Dr. Mist, again, another individual that comes from way back when. Actually, let me just really quick, I just want to point out, Dr. Destiny, just did a wiki thing on him when I was doing research for this episode. The one that they have is Dr. Destiny from JLA, or Justice League of America, Volume 1, number 176. The artist was Dick Dillon. I think it's hilarious. He looks exactly like Skeletor from He-Man, Masters of the Universe. I'm not 100% sure it would make sense if it says here, JLA, Volume 1, number 5, is 1961. In June, that's the sixth month. That would mean that the first issue came out in February for JLA. Which would mean if it's 176, you got to divide that by 12. 144 is 12, 156, 168, so 14 years, 1975, yep, I believe Dr. Destiny came before Skeletor, at least Skeletor in his weird cut-up purple hoodie from the cartoon. I'm saying, like, I didn't like the cartoon, I loved that cartoon when I was a kid, I watched all of it, Thundercats, He-Man, She-Ra, all of it. Somehow I missed Jem and the Holograms, yet damn near every woman I've ever dated saw that show. I don't know how I missed that show. It had to have been on the same network. But anyway, that's Dr. Destiny. There's some stuff in his past, but for the most part, we'll end up getting into that later on in the series, more specifically in Justice League Dark. The individual may or may not pop up again. All you need to know is He has the ability to manipulate people's dreams, apparently anyone. And he also has an extensive medical knowledge, which I think might have just been shoehorned in because, you know, his name is Dr. Dr. Destiny. The individual that they're all going after is Dr. Mist. Everybody, Zatanna, John Constantine, and co. They're going after Dr. Mist, an individual who is said in this particular iteration to have been working with Black Orchid on a previous mission. And they're going to go retrieve him. What's stated here is that he got his powers, quote-unquote, after exposure to the Pillar of Life, which endowed him with immortality. He can also cast spells of illusion and enchantment, according to one of his origins, used to craft magical gems, which there goes right back to Dr. Destiny's Dream Stone, as if there's some kind of connection there that Dr. Mist is needed to create something for Felix Faust. I won't spoil anything really, but what I will talk about is this pillar aspect, and at least the correlation. I don't want to spoil anything because there's a definite connection, which I feel like has played out somewhat, but not fully, between Shazam, where he gets his powers from, I would say the other side of the coin of the Trinity, so the side that we normally see, the more mainstays being Wonder Woman, Superman, and Batman. The other side that was introduced in the New 52 were the Phantom Stranger, Pandora, and the Question. Those three individuals, what their motivations were, their backstories, all those things, you can find out on your own by reading the graphic novels. But they all, those three, that other side of the Trinity, are all connected to Shazam, who is now connected to the other side of the Trinity. You know, there's this weird connection going on with magic, with the occult, and being the driving force for a lot of the actions of the quote-unquote good guys and gals of the DC multiverse. I won't go that much into depth of what the Pillars of Life are in the DC multiverse and the role of magic, because you should really find that out on your own and or through this podcast as we go along. What is fascinating is the correlation between the Pillars of Life and, in, as I mentioned earlier, existential psychotherapy or existential therapy, and the what's the best way to say this? The four aspects of life, as it says on Wikipedia, it's a method of therapy that operates on the belief that inner conflict, or, you know, the problems that all of us go through in our own minds, are due to our own confrontation with things that are just normal in life. It says the givens of existence, but it's highfalutin talk. It's things that everyone has to face at one time in their life or another, or at least everyone is expected to face. They may or may not. They might be an orphan, they might die young, who knows? Or they might live in a secluded area in the world and they just don't face reality the same way other people do. But if we're talking about just the general populace, there are things that we all face and phases that we all go through having to deal with that. These four pillars of existence, if you will, it's stated here that it was noted by Irvin D. Yalom, are the inevitability of death, freedom, and all the responsibility that comes with having freedom. It says existential isolation, but it's really feeling like you're alone in the grand scheme of things. And then the fourth pillar being meaninglessness. There's a difference between feeling like you're alone in the world, because you can feel like you're alone but feel like you have something to say, or you can feel like you're alone and feel like you have nothing to say, thusly why you're alone. That's completely different from feeling as if existence is meaningless or that you are meaningless. That's a completely different realm. As it says here, these four aspects, it says Givens, these four aspects of reality that people face, referred to as quote-unquote ultimate concerns, form the body of existential psychotherapy. And they compose the framework in which a therapist conceptualizes a client or a person's problem in order to develop a method of treatment. So they kind of look at those four doors that, in essence, somebody would be standing in front of questioning themselves, trying to figure out exactly what their purpose is and whether they should or should not go through the door. And the psychotherapist, the therapist will, in essence, walk up behind them and tell them that what's on the other side of the door can't be that difficult to face, because in essence that person wouldn't be the first to face it, nor will they be the last. There are four different worlds, as it were, in this line of thinking. I'm going to quote here: the way in which a person in the world at a particular stage can be charted on a general map of existence. Okay? It can be distinguished by four basic dimensions of human existence. That is the physical, the social, the spiritual, and the psychological. Okay? On each of these dimensions, people encounter the world and shape their attitude out of their particular take on their experience. Their orientation towards the world defines their reality. The way that they view the world, the way that the world seems to play itself out in front of them, ends up being how they define what is real and what isn't, what is good, what is bad. The moral compass is shaped by their ability to understand what's going on around them. Quoting again, these four dimensions are obviously interwoven and provide a complex, I would assume very complex, four-dimensional force. It says force field, but a four-dimensional force that helps to maintain the existence. And I like the idea of it being a four-dimensional force, because it's kind of going outside of the bounds of the understanding of a three-dimensional plane of existence and going towards space. That's what the fourth dimension is, space. Fifth dimension is time. Kind of being able to embody any space at any moment. The different dimensions that people kind of view life through are the physical dimension, which is the Umwelt, Umwelt. The psychological dimension, the Eigerwelt. The social dimension, the Mitwelt, or the Mitwelt. And the spiritual dimension, the Überwelt. Now, on the spiritual dimension, quoting Van Dierzen in 1984, individuals relate to the unknown and thus create a sense of an ideal world, an ideology, and a philosophical outlook. It's here that they find meaning by putting all the pieces of the puzzle together for themselves. Now, for some people, this is done by adhering to a religion. I'll say that again. For some people, this is done by adhering to a religion or other prescriptive worldview. The other prescriptive worldview being, as you would assume, people that ingrain themselves in a political ideology. For others, it is about discovering or attributing meaning in a more secular or personal way. So they might not be trying to influence world events or their community, locally speaking, but they're trying to make something make more sense to themselves. The contradictions that must be faced on this dimension are often related to the tension between purpose and absurdity. It goes on to say hope and despair, but I think what's hilarious is that it's in essence saying that the problem that people have when they try and sort things out in this metaphysical realm within their mind of the quote-unquote spiritual dimension, the problems they face are whether what they're trying to reconcile is actually purposeful or belongs in the realm of being just absurd, pointless, not worth ruminating over. To go on to quote, people create their values in search of something that matters enough to live or die for, something that may even have ultimate and universal validity. And this is where we get into kind of the American mindset a little bit more now. Usually the aim is the conquest of a soul, whether it's your own or someone else's, or something that will substantially surpass mortality. For instance, in having contributed something valuable to humankind. Facing the void and the possibility of nothingness are the indispensable counterparts of this quest for the eternal. you could see that the spiritual dimension is the realm of individuals who are religious practitioners, whether it's the religions that are known a little bit more well-known, well-publicized, Judeo-Christian, Islamic faiths, Judeo-Christian faiths, Buddhism, Shintoism. I think I'm just going to do that alphabetically from now on because it makes it seem like I have a preference over another, and I really don't. Or the occult, in that religious bubble, or people who use this mindscape of this is how things could be. You know, this is how things were, this is how things are, this is how things could be, and I'm going to put all that together in my mind, given what I know. They use that in that bubble, and as well the political bubble, that sphere, the political sphere, which I think is hilarious. People say sphere, it is a bubble. You're inside this ideology, and you're not giving yourself a chance to go outside of it and say, is what I'm doing right or wrong from the perspective of someone else. They just see what they're doing as just right, which is a bad way to go about things. It's fascinating that those two groups of individuals are doing what they're doing because they're constantly faced with the thought that in the end it doesn't matter. Whether it's in religion or the occult, and that after you die, there is nothing. So something is created to justify existence in the first place. You know, if there is no benevolent creator, female or male, or groups of people, then why do we exist and do the things that we do? Would it just be because of chemicals flowing through the brain and acting on instincts that were learned instincts, or instincts that were already ingrained, to bypass that very, very, very daunting reality for most, not even for some, the specter of a deity is, or at least the shadow of it, is hid under by individuals who practice certain religions. In the political sphere, people will use the ideal of, oh, this is the society we're trying to create, so I will continue to follow this thought process until we get to that society, not knowing whether that society could actually ever come into existence, or if it ever really needs to come into existence. I think that's very fascinating that both of those individuals, they could cross over, it could be a Venn diagram, but for the most part, if you were to just keep them separate and say, oh no, it's two different people, apostates, individuals that are adherents to a religion, and people that are adherents to a political ideology, that both of those individuals, thinking they're going on separate paths, are really walking down the same road towards oblivion. I think that's very fascinating, and a very interesting theme that has started in this issue and will pick up in subsequent issues, not only in the story arcs that are going to play out, but the character arcs for the different individuals that are a part of this, as I said before, eclectic group of lost individuals. I would say, you know, okay, they go about their business, they get to where they're trying to get to, actions occur, beautiful splash pages, where you can see Andrew Bennett perform a very Dracula-esque vampire move, as opposed to, I was going to say something wrong, but I shouldn't. He just shows his true colors, as do some of the other individuals, which is very fascinating. See Black Orchid be used to great effect. That sounds horrible. Use her powers to great effect. And then we get the reveal of what the goal point, I guess you would say, the goal post for this particular mission was, which is what sets up everything else for the, I would say, pretty much up until the current run, even though this arc leads into an intriguing arc that does have a beginning, middle, and end, and then goes to something else. I believe it still is playing out up till now, but I stopped reading Justice League Dark for this podcast. I wanted to keep it fresh. I just want to point out, if you want to do your own little research, look up 8-dimensional map. It's something that's referenced in this issue. But yes, we come to an end, and I feel as if, given everything that I've spoken on and what goes on in this issue, the central theme is deceit. not so much using deception in the present to get what you want, but the idea that deceit is prevalent in the past, present, and future, that deceit was used in the past to get people to do what they want. It's shown in a, you know, previously on Justice League Dark, in essence, they have a week ago, deceit is used by John Constantine to recruit the people to go on this bizarre mission in the Amazon. No relation to Wonder Woman and the Amazons. This is literally in South America, in Brazil, if I'm not mistaken. They had just come off of just the bizarre occurrences of the last 8 issues, all the crap that Rackshade was going through, and the disappearance, in essence, of Mind Warp. That individual, as bizarre as he is as well, after going through all that, John Constantine still uses deceit as a way to get these people together as opposed to honesty. Black Orchid's whole existence is one of the deceit, whether it's her power set or her skill set, her power set, what her powers are. Again, trying not to spoil too much stuff, but one of them being shapeshifting, and the skill set, her being an operative for the government. That's a spy. She's a deceitful individual. You know, and you could even go to Felix Faust. What you are assuming he's doing in this issue, what you're led to believe in the subsequent issues, and what actually goes down further down the road, that's all just a long con. Just layers and layers of deceit. So to have the starting point for this new direction for this team, whether it's this fictional team of characters or the creative team behind this graphic novel, this new pillar, if you will, that's being erected on the foundation of this Justice League Dark graphic novel series, is very fascinating, especially for it being what it is, not being able to trust anyone, not just the narrator, but who's being narrated. Again, fascinating issue, just like all the rest of them, you know, because this medium is full of people who were in love with it. I highly doubt that graphic novels, especially in at DC Comics, that I wasn't stumbling because I didn't remember. I was going to say a bunch of other different places. I was just talking about DC from now on. Shouldn't have even said that. But again, I told you guys, no editing. They wouldn't go out of their way to stay around and write these stories if they didn't believe they were worth telling. Whether they believe they were the best stories or the worst stories is out of the question. It's just not what's under the microscope here. What is what ends up bleeding out of the souls of these individuals, what these people end up divulging onto the paper, whether it's words or inks or colors or pencils or, you know, rewriting a scene so that it fits a greater narrative. To do all those things with the passion that they've done it with takes a lot of dedication, and it's a beautiful art form that is the template for a lot of the big tentpole blockbuster films that have been coming out over the last decade. I would say with the last 20 years, really, not the last decade. I mean, superhero films, they've existed since the serials what's his name? I was going to say John, but that's not right. It was before Chris Reeves, and not Matt Reeves, because that's a modern-day storyteller. But one of the Reeves that played the black and white Superman. It was Superman and the Mole Man, or, you know, the old Batman and Robin serials, which are interesting. They're very bizarre to look at, very akin to the cliffhanger episodes, cliffhanger-esque show, Flash Gordon, but before the movie, the actual black and white Flash Gordon. The movie was awesome, too. That's a whole other conversation. I say last 20 years because, like, 96, so we can just include Blade as well. This need for the American populace to escape from reality, to see themselves as a better individual or an individual who is exacting justice, whether it's a Blade or a Punisher, and the three different iterations we've now gotten in the last 20 years. Or, it was really 30 years, because it's Dolph Lundgren as well. great movie, underrated. Or it's the idealistic versions of ourselves that are exacting vengeance. a Batman, a Superman, a... I was going to say that... not Devil Dog, that's an actual food. Dylan Dog? I think that's it. I really was just trying to pull that because I wanted to pull something else. But yeah, even Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Or a... I was going to say Baps, and Baps is not a superhero movie. Wow. If anyone knows what Baps is, you're welcome for that chuckle. And where did that co-star go? I really wanted to see her in more stuff. The fact that I don't remember her name says a lot for me, and I guess a lot of other people. Not fair to her. Great actress. Halle Berry's great too, of course. But there's a need to not pay attention to what's going on around us, and I guess you could bracket it between... Timothy McVeigh and the 19 hijackers in September of 2001. That time period created this tumult that allowed for the mainstream to need to escape, and the resurgence of really the death of soap operas and the resurgence of reality television. I say resurgence because it did exist before a candid camera, all that stuff, but it's just this new way of looking at putting a camera in people's faces and making other people feel bad, in essence, for what they're doing, and you feel good for that. Or having these ideals created. And it started with this cult group of people. That's a horrible word. A smaller group that were initially watching The X-Files. And it grew and grew and grew to this point of just this general distrust of the government that, of course, existed before, but during the Cold War, it's not like people would have distrusted the U.S. government as a mainstay. As a mainstay, be like, oh no, the U.S. government is trying. There's a bunch of messed up people in there, you know, i.e. Iran-Contra in the 80s, Oliver North people. But for the most part, I prefer America over other countries. It was the mid to late 90s where people started to say, well, wait a minute, I don't know about all that anymore. Like, we might be a great country, but there's some messed up stuff that we do, and oh look, this country does stuff that's cool, they do a lot of bad stuff, they do some cool stuff, so let me go visit there. So to have this escape from the reality around us, as well as the escape from the dangers that kept presenting themselves from people that were seeing the patina start to fade on the brass poles that hold up the awning that is the entrance to the United States. You know, I could have used a better analogy. Patina that has long since faded on the Statue of Liberty on Liberty Island. That's better. Those individuals that did the horrible things that they did in that bracket period, like I said, between Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombings and then, you know, the first World Trade Center bombings, which were in the basement. They blew up generators in the basement, and that's why they ended up putting generators outside in these bizarre squares. It was really weird. You don't, unless you lived in New York and or visited there a bunch of times, you wouldn't even know what the hell I'm talking about. Or you, I guess you could research it too, but you can't go there and see something like that now. It's not there anymore. And then, you know, with what ended up going down in September of the year before 2002, I'm just trying not to get flagged here, people. That's the world we live in. That paranoia that some black ops group, you know, think V for Vendetta. You can think the graphic novel, or you could think the film, if that's all you've been privy to. And, you know, the black-booted troops kicking in your door because you have a different way of thinking than other people. That fear, coupled with all the other fears and aggression that has been welling up in the American populace, has kind of necessitated the need to placate and to create worlds that seem better than what's going on now. And I think I'll end this off with from now and again I'll be talking about the Matrix. I love the Matrix. I love the trilogy. I love the Animatrix. I love Enter the Matrix, which is an amazing game. I love that game. And I even like Path of Neo. Never played the Massively Multiplayer Online, the MMO. I think it was MMORPG actually. I didn't understand before what people had a problem with The Matrix Reloaded and then Revolutions. And then I realized it the more that I watched the film. And it really was that I believe people thought that The Matrix would be destroyed. I think that's what they believe the outcome would have been. So if you look at the second movie, everything that's building up is, you know, oh man, you know, we're kind of screwed. Things don't look that great, but at least we got Neo. And you get to the third movie and it's like, oh no, Neo's kind of like out of commission. He's not a part of the war effort anymore. Now we have to fight for ourselves. We are powerless against this machine, the literal machine. And now we are relying on this individual to save us. And he doesn't. Not in the way that they want. They wanted the machines to die. They wanted Zion to rise, in essence, not even in essence, literally and figuratively, to rise from the depths of the earth to the surface world and bring back the sun. All kinds of allegories there. I meant S-U-N, not S-O-N. But he went to the surface and found that if the machines did not exist, because of humanity, we would really just create the cycle all over again. Whether it's in a year or in 10,000 years, it would get to the point where we would get tired. Look at the Animatrix. We would get tired of working and find a way to subvert that, to go towards playing more often. So to create some kind of bargain, to fix the glitch in the program, that being Agent Smith, a program, an aspect of life that doesn't see life as worth living anymore. And you could look at that as a terrorist or a patriot, whatever you want to look at that as as a real world allegory. That deal that was made between Neo and the Matrix itself, in essence, to fix the problem in the Matrix so the Matrix can go about what it's doing, so that now everybody, all the billions of people in the Matrix, stay in the Matrix, keep going about their day-to-day lives, but as happy as they can become, because that's what they want for themselves. Look back at the first Matrix movie. They tried other stuff. Or it's the people of Zion who really do revel in the ability to be able to go in and out of the Matrix. And so long as you don't create problems, you can go ahead and have fun in that video game. What other outcome could there have been? That was the best solution for world peace. And I think that really pissed people off, because it could have just been, oh, let's scorch the earth and destroy everything and have all these people coming out from these caverns in this darkened sky with just very, very few rays of light shining down, and all these broken machines everywhere. I think that's what people would have wanted to see, with Neo rising into the sky, not being able to use his powers in the real world. That's not realistic. It would never happen like that. The way that the Matrix went down, every single one of the films, whether it be the three films or the vignettes in the Animatrix, that's how humans would have played things out. It's unfortunate, but true. And I think that's why people didn't like it. I don't think it's really the reasons that they cited. It just might have been harder to articulate that. And I just spoke for a billion people that probably really don't want me to speak for them. So I'm going to stop doing that. And then instead tell you can go ahead and email the show. Knock yourself out. DarkerCornersCast@gmail.com. As I always say, it's DarkerCornersCast@gmail.com. You know, like a group of people on a stage, all using the exact same voice to trick the audience into thinking that only one actor is on stage, but it's eight different people performing Hamlet. That's right, I just compared this podcast to Shakespeare. You can follow the show on Twitter @DarkerCorners. That's with a capital D and a capital C. Or a capital C or a capital D if you're dyslexic like myself. There's a link in the header that's going to take you either to the website or to iTunes. Depends on how I'm feeling at the moment. It's a good chance it's just going to take you straight to iTunes. But who knows? Who knows? It might feel cool to send you to the website instead. And of course, go rate the show on iTunes, because you're a nice person and nice people do nice things. This has been the 9th episode. I have been Nick Antoine. You have been the unwitting listener. Thank you for listening. Step into the dark.